It's time now for World Watchers International with Mae Brussel, who for over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's Mae.
Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's February 21st, 1982, and it's program number 533. Happiness is having some new filing cabinets, and one of the persons who subscribes to the tapes and listens got four cabinets for me this week. That's 16 nice drawers to put material in. Things were really getting out of hand, and I appreciate that. It's great to have these, and I'll be stacking them up this week. I didn't have time the past week, but I can't wait to put some of the articles in there that have been in boxes. It's almost impossible to retrieve some of the information I have. I get letters asking for material all the time, and one reason I don't answer the letters is that they get buried under other articles sometimes, and maybe this will help the situation out. I just briefly want to mention three movies that are out at the present time. I'm not going into detail about them, except about one of them, maybe for a few minutes. Three interesting movies out. One is Reds, the other is Missing, and the third is My Dinner with Andre. First of all, I believe Reds is the most overestimated movie of the year. I thought it was horrible, and I've gotten some letters about it. I'll go into details about it some other evening when I have 3 or 4 minutes. I don't think it describes anything that actually went on in the Soviet Union or in the United States realistically. I think it was a super sales job. William Buckley thought it was a good idea that it played in the White House because it was so bad, and it was a typical kind of movie that Ronald Reagan would enjoy. I didn't like the movie. It doesn't matter how many picture awards it's nominated for, and my taste isn't considered in giving the awards. I just think it's a lot of hours about nothing. I would prefer spending the time and money learning something new and hopefully factual, or comparing pieces of information for an experience that has more basis in reality. I just thought it was horrible. The best movie that I've seen, and I don't see that many, is My Dinner with Andre. I guess that's because I'm an existentialist at heart. My favorite playwright is Samuel Beckett. My favorite plays are Waiting for Godot and Endgame. And I haven't seen a movie like this for many, many years. It's absolutely brilliant. And the subject is one that interests me, which is alienation. It's very difficult to get people to wake up or shake up to the reality of things that it didn't happen after World War I or World War II, even with the Holocaust and the atomic bomb, and we see people today immobilized. The Secretary of State could declare war, have his way in almost any country, and we would just be obliged to probably follow along. People feel a lot of things today, but they're unable to verbalize about it or to do anything about it. And two characters in the play who have dinner together, one of them is able through his life to make changes. He sees changes, he moves along, he makes decisions, he thinks about things, he discusses things, he is able to share some of his feelings and to share the growth process of thinking. And his old buddy who has dinner with him is just simply treading mill and standing. He's just standing still, and time just swallows up everything that he's done. He isn't going any place. His ideas haven't grown. And the thing they have in common is a long friendship from a long time ago. Neither learns from the other particularly, and that's about the way life is most of the time. I am sorry to say that even among a lot of people, a select group, say researchers who do work on the kind of things that I do, that listen to the broadcasts, that collect books, that collect articles, when you talk to each of these people one-to-one, you can have a wonderful dialogue. You get three in a room, and they're totally bananas. Not one of them will think of a subject to bring up. That all three never talk of one thing at one time. They're as far removed from what is current in the news that day as can be, and it's an interesting phenomenon. It would be depressing if I wasn't a philosophy major and an existentialist. I accept it as it is. I remember when I was in New York several years ago, there was a gathering of World Watcher friends that take the tapes and listen, and we had a wonderful day the whole day talking, and I can't remember any other time where I was with a group of researchers where we were able to have a continuous conversation such as Andre has in this movie, and that each person understood what the other one was saying. But for the most part, people are very isolated, and they think their own thoughts, and even if they share the same thoughts, they can't move on them, and they're literally paralyzed. It's a tragic situation, but it's a fact that exists, and it's captured brilliantly in the movie My Dinner with Andre. And the other movie that I wanted to talk about, not far apart from Andre, is the movie Missing. That is a new picture out. It's a true story. It's a screenplay by Costa Gavras. And some of you may have seen some of the other movies he made, starting with Z, and he did State of Siege. There are many books on the problems in Chile, the overturning of Allende's government, the killing of this poor young American that was down there at the time, the victim, Charles Horman, who's the Horman, H-O-R-M-A-N, who's the subject of this movie, Missing. I'll give you the title of some of the books. They've been out for a long time, and information on this subject. It's nice that it's a movie now, and I understand they're standing in line to see it. So that is an introduction to the population at large about a situation that occurred a while ago. I have a book from Amnesty International, Report on Torture, published in 1973 by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux in New York. And they go into Chile and William Colby testifying that the Nixon administration gave $8 million for covert activities in Chile between 1970 and 73 to overthrow the government. Gerald Ford was asked when he was president, and this is the book from Amnesty International, he was asked about the role of the United States in Chile. The question is, and this was given to Gerald Ford, who was a member of the Warren Commission covering up the murder of President John Kennedy before the president of Chile was killed a few years later. The question, what was international law? Under international law, do we have a right to destabilize constitutionally elected government of another country? Gerald Ford answered, I'm not going to pass judgment on whether it is permitted or authorized under international law. It is a recognized fact that historically as well as presently, such actions are taken in the best interests of the countries involved. So that it doesn't have to be against a law to do it. The actions are taken in the best interests of the countries involved. And that is the United States also. Gerald Ford covered up and was active in the covering up for the CIA and the Defense Department who killed John Kennedy. And he says, I don't pass judgment on this kind of law. It's in the best interest of the countries involved. Another book, Assassination on Embassy Row by John Dinge, D-I-N-G-E-S, and Saul Landau, published by Pantheon Books in 1980. It tells about General Vernon Walters, a deputy director of the CIA, meeting with Manuel Contreras in the CIA headquarters in Washington, D.C. And I mentioned before in regards to this book the way to come to Washington to kill Orlando Letelier, who had worked with the Chilean government. He was living in Washington, D.C., the former ambassador to Chile. They stopped in Munich, Germany, where the Chilean police, put in by the CIA, the DINA, the DINA, cultivated contacts with former Nazi sympathizers associated with Christian social union leader Franz Josef Strauss. And then they came on to the United States. Townley was from the Ford Motor Company and from NASA, and he was involved in killing Letelier. And that was the murder on Embassy Row. It was called Assassination on Embassy Row. I have the Senate hearings from the Senate Committee in 1975, the alleged assassination plots involving foreign leaders. And this section has many foreign leaders in it, that were killed by the CIA, and it begins September the 4th, 1970. Dr. Salvador Allende Gossens won a plurality in Chile's presidential election. On September the 15th, 1970, 11 days later, President Richard Nixon informed the CIA director Richard Helms that an Allende regime in Chile would not be acceptable to the United States. And the CIA was instructed by President Nixon to play a direct role to organize a military coup d'etat in Chile. That's from the Senate hearings. Another book I referred to on the program, Death in Washington, The Murder of Orlando Letelier by Donald Freed and Dr. Fred Landis, L-A-N-D-I-S. And, of course, the people involved in these murders were responsible for the execution also of Charles Horman when, at the time, Allende was murdered. This book goes into various people working with the Chilean government and the agencies that were involved in these murders. The first listed here is Georgia Congressman Larry McDonald, and I've gone into the testimony before the House Select Committee hearings, the private hearings, of Robert Byron Watson, of Larry McDonald at DeKalb County in Georgia, and linked that assassination team to Mark David Chapman and the John Lennon murder. Larry McDonald is mentioned here as one of the people working with the William Buckley Circle and the CIA in the Chilean overthrow and murders. The second group is called the Accuracy in Media, a right-wing propaganda group that sends out anti-communist literature. Third, the American Chilean Council, a budget of $100,000 yearly for propaganda from the CIA. Four, the use of Reverend Moon, self-proclaimed South Korean messiah, who's tied to the Korean CIA. And presently, I got information, Reverend Moon's people are on the campus at San Francisco State University working for military intervention in El Salvador at the present time. And fifth, this book mentioned Young Americans for Freedom, an organization started in the 1960s by William Buckley and E. Howard Hunt. And the YAF had a very major role in the assassination of John Kennedy. All of these people that were behind the execution of Charles Horman and Salvador Allende or Linda Letelier go right back to the murder of John Kennedy. There is the book, The Execution of Charles Horman by Thomas Hauser, published by Avon Books in 1978. It tells about Salvador Allende's military people around him, where they were trained. Mr. Pinochet was trained in the United States. He trained in the armed forces in the USA since 1936. He was on active duty in the United States, just as Gaddafi was trained in the United States. These military dictators are here. And this book goes into 14 American bases in the Canal Zone, administered by the United States with special forces. This is where the police are sent from all over the world, and they were part of this coup that killed Charles Horan. Now, the very sad thing about this is that if the Horman family helped the researchers find out who killed John Kennedy from 1963 to 1973, then they might have saved their own son's life, because the same people that were in on the murder of John Kennedy were killing Charles Horman. The advertisement for the movie in all the newspapers reads, "Charles Horman thought that being an American would guarantee his safety. His family that believed that being Americans would guarantee them the truth. They were all wrong." And I might say to you, and I have said this on the air for 11 years, that if you think that being an American guarantees your safety, you're wrong. If you think that it guarantees truth, you're wrong again. The government has been lying to you for a long, long time, and I can date my studies with the Kennedy assassination and going back to the earlier lies or the current lies. You are no safer than Charles Horman. Your children are no safer than Charles Horman. My children are no safer, and no one in this country is. And the problem is that if you can't see these things, you can take a very good movie. It's an isolated case of one American boy. But there's going to be more. Believe me, there's going to be more. And if people can't study these things, if they are as alienated as Samuel Beckett says, or as in the movie My Dinner with Andre, if they remain alienated and can't get their rockers together, then there is nothing left but the consequences of this paralysis, which people have felt through the years and are unable to act appropriately to the dangers that are around them. There's another book, Hidden Terrors, by A.J. Languth, Pantheon Books, 1978. And it goes into Dan Mitrione, who was in Uruguay, the chief of police, and the links of Dan Mitrione to Brazil and to Chile and the United States training of Mitrione. He also was with Jim Jones in Brazil and worked for the CIA and was trained in torture, all kinds of torture, in South America. And this book goes into particularly Uruguay and Dan Mitrione, but the problems in South America with the United States training torture. And there's another book, Covert Action in Chile, put out, this is by the Senate, a report, 1963 to 1973, United States Senate, again in 1975, and it has a chronological date of March 25th, 1970, the committee, 40 committee in Washington, the National Security Council meeting with John McCone, former CIA director, and now board of the ITT Corporation and planning to stop the elections, along with Richard Helms of Salvador Allende, and the interference of ITT and the CIA and the mingling of private corporations, Harold Janine and ITT's chief executive with John McCone and Henry Kissinger, and how they sit in Washington to affect elections. And Henry Kissinger said it was a massive problem as Salvador Allende got into office, and the White House, the National Security Advisor, the President, the whole gang, the Pentagon, go in and kill Americans if they know too much. And that's the way the cookie crumbles. There was a section of the book, The Execution of Charles Horman, in Penthouse in November 78. And the reason I bring out all these titles and books is that the problem in Chile came out at the time of Watergate. It came out the Center Church hearings, the Rockefeller Committee hearings. These are not new situations. But the problem is that Alexander Haig and Henry Kissinger and the Defense Department and the same people that gave you the murder of Charles Horman or Salvador Allende are planning the bloodbath in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Guatemala. They came back from Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam, and they'll give you a bloodbath in any country that they feel that they want to do it in. And General Haig has said it doesn't matter what the American people think or feel, he'll do what's necessary. That's Gerald Ford's philosophy. And only when we stand up and yell about who is in office and demand that they be removed for some of their direct link to these past crimes, only then, and if that were possible, would be able to avert some terrible mass murders that are going to be the guilt and responsibility on our own hands. I don't see where we're any different than Germany going to Poland or any of the other countries, or France or Holland or Italy or Romania or anywhere in Europe or in Africa or South Africa, wherever Hitler or Mussolini went. The people couldn't stop them, and we can't stop our government, and there aren't enough people to sit and have conversations on what to do. They can't even verbalize the problem, much less the action. They just sit with their mouth open and individually say on the telephone or socially, isn't it terrible? And beyond that, there isn't much that they can organize and think about. It's other than it being horrendous, there aren't two or three people that can sit in any one room and make a decision on what to do. I want to mention very quickly a couple of items this week and then go back to the Air Florida flight and also some complications of interlocking links that I brought up before, and continue on Fritz Kramer, the mentor of Alexander Haig and Henry Kissinger, the man behind these bloodbaths down in Central and South America right now. There's one death on the freeway up here in California, got very little notice and only in one paper. The title is Ex-Spy's Death, No Mystery. Well, it can't be a mystery if it's never looked into. This is the San Francisco Chronicle, February 17th, 1982, last Wednesday. A man who worked for the Central Intelligence Agency 20 years was killed in a hit-and-run accident out here in Redwood City. His name is Edward Ellis Smith. Now, he died February the 13th, 1982. Raymond Brochure from the CIA died January the 14th, just a month before. And Max Kirshner, a nephew of Vito Genovese, who worked for the CIA as a hitman, died January 21st. So there was one death on the 14th of a CIA man, one 7 days later of Max Kirshner, and then 3 weeks later, Edward Ellis Smith. Smith worked with the Army, the State Department. He became an author. A sports car came and ran him down. He allegedly had with him papers similar to what John Paisley had or Frank Nugent. They were papers in his briefcase for a book, references to the CIA and the KGB. The traffic sergeant, Richard Morton, said there's no reason to think the death was anything but accidental. That's like the Karen Silkwood and about 200 other car deaths. No arrests and no mention of the suspect's name. It's been withheld. Smith worked as chief of security for the Moscow embassy in the 1950s. It doesn't say what years. Gene Harris was with Dr. Tannauer in the Moscow embassy in 1959. Lee Harvey Oswald was there in 59. Walter Stessel, who's now deputy director of the State Department under Alexander Haig, was the ambassador to the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. Harvey Oswald and Marina were active at that embassy starting in 1959. Arrangements were made for Lee Harvey's arrival in 1959. This fellow wrote books on Stalin, on Soviet affairs. His attorney in Palo Alto said there wasn't much comment. His name is John Gunn. You might want to look that up in relation to other cases. He said very little on this, if anything. The body was sent to Parkersburg, West Virginia. The burial is Arlington National Cemetery. And I just wonder what he knew about Lee Harvey Oswald and William Stessel and the general, the whole National Security Council, George Bush and Mr. Pipes, and that gang worked with the Soviet Union. And this guy was run down by a sports car. Nobody's held, no names. But that's another primary witness of the embassy at this time that has met a strange death. Another important death this last week, and I'll do a lot more maybe next week because I want to cover this other material, is Noah Dietrich. He was the head of the Howard Hughes organization, the Hughes Empire, for 33 years. The Dietrich saga is a long, interesting, going back to Doheny Oil and the Teapot Dome scandal. And then Howard was left an orphan when he was 19, and his daddy had the tool bit that drilled into the hardest surface of the earth for oil, and therefore all oil companies were dependent upon Hughes' tool bit for this device of breaking into the earth for oil. I'll do more on Dietrich. I just wanted to mention that he passed this week. And also in We Magazine, February 1982, there's an article by Terry Moore. She refers to a book that she's writing, Howard Be Thy Name. And she mentions in here that she doesn't believe all the stories they told about Howard Hughes. And she says, questioning his death, May Brussel believes, and they will not disprove her, that he's been dead for quite a while. That it was not Howard who was in the grave. That's a man named Vance Cooper who doubled for Howard, who disappeared at the same time. No one's been able to find him. She really believes that Vance was buried and not Howard. Well, Terry knows that I believe that. That's true. And the Summa Corporation has never challenged me, never sued me. And I have verification from people, a double for Howard Hughes and people at work with him and Johnny Meyer, who worked for the Hughes Corporation, that was Vance Cooper and is Vance Cooper in the grave. He was last seen a long time ago. He was the voice of Howard, and that was not Howard Hughes buried in 1976. There also is an article in today's Chronicle, and some of you want to get it fast this week before it gets buried in the dead news pile. I don't know if the libraries back east carry the Chronicle or not. It's a story of George I. Benny, B-E-N-N-Y. There's $18 million missing. The title is Key Figure in a Chicago Title Suit, $18 million. It has to do with the Wells Fargo Bank giving him many millions of dollars out here in California. He had a construction loan of over $250 million. He lives in Hillsborough, California. He was a man who came from Hungary, worked for sewer department, building sewers, and worked for the U.S. military. Then his brother came from Hungary, and all of a sudden he had many, many millions of dollars. At the present time, $18 million is gone, and I wonder if these sums of money are missing on the books to go back to stir up trouble in Hungary, such as the Solidarity has been doing in Poland. Watch the case because the suit is just taking place in Chicago. It's $18 million. And, of course, I watched the missing money from the Wells Fargo Bank with interest, the huge sums that are missing because Harold Smith said there were $200 to $300 million that have been gone over the past 20 years and not the $23 million they had accused him of taking. He said he was a front for that operation. One quick article from the New York Times, in case you missed it. Pakistan ousts the U.S. Chief of Malaria Research Center. In Pakistan, the American Army has been breeding a disease-bearing mosquito to use in Afghanistan and Cuba, and they're using unsuspecting Pakistanis as guinea pigs. It's set up in Maryland by American doctors and Israeli doctors, and they've had this laboratory at the University of Maryland since 1962, but they've now sent information testing people in Pakistan, and they're unsuspecting. They don't know that this is going on. Moscow picked up the facts of the biological warfare in Pakistan. They've issued reports on Russian shortwave, and it's in the New York Times, the United States breeding mosquitoes, and we'll let them loose and give malaria in Afghanistan, probably blame the Soviet Union and use it as a weapon against Cuba. So you can be looking for more outbreak of malaria. And the Soviet Union got access to these documents. Now, this week, this coming Tuesday, there's going to be a meeting in Rome of the Pope. He was on 60 Minutes tonight, and a Catholic from one city in the United States described him as an actor, that everything he does is studied, and that he is really trained as an actor. The meeting is the Opus Dei, D-E-I. The Opus Dei means God's work. And the Opus Dei was set up in Italy in 1929, at the time that the Germans and the Italians were getting ready for World War II to get the anti-Christ, the Soviet Union, and wage war against the Soviet Union and demand loyalty of all the people in the Catholic Church to obey the Pope. The present predicament of this company is deepened by Pope John Paul II's interest in Opus Dei, founded in 1928 by Father Jose Maria de Balaguer. There's a long article in the magazine section of the New York Times last Sunday by Paul Hoffman in the San Francisco Chronicle, February 21st, 1982. The article says John Paul II first came to know of Opus Dei during his many trips to Rome and to other parts of the world when he was still Archbishop of Krakow. He probably was attracted by the association's orthodoxy and their way of getting things done. Opus Dei was a violently anti-communist organization, and he would become active in his homeland in Poland. Now, this Pope, John Paul II, I've mentioned many times, worked for IG Farben at Auschwitz. It was a subsidiary, the Solvay Chemical. At the time of the exterminations, he wasn't a priest at the time. He was an actor. He went to Pope Paul VI, who was writing passports as the Secretary of the Vatican, for Nazis, and he was the protege in Rome at the time he learned of this organization. Now, he's going to have a showdown of the Jesuit priests. Some people feel the Jesuits are too far right, and one branch of the Jesuits is too far left. But the tone of the article is disturbed by liberal ferment. The Pope has summoned leaders of his vanguard to a historic conclave in Rome. He is worried that the priests are getting too much of a conscience, and he's called them in, and he's going to crack down on them. The Auschwitz Pope is going to crack down, if he can, this coming Tuesday, on the Jesuits. The title of the article in San Francisco is "The Pope versus the Jesuits, Disturbed by Liberal Ferment. The Pope has summoned the leaders of his vanguard to a historic showdown in Rome." There hasn't been anything like it since the Catholic Church shut up and supported Adolf Hitler, Mussolini, and Franco, and the fascist regimes in order to hopefully conquer the Antichrist, which was the Soviet Union. When the Pope was shot last May on broadcast number 493, I listed why would anybody want to shoot the Pope. I listed five possible motives and ruled out two of the five. And one of them was, the second one was, that the far, far right, much more fascist than most military governments today, want no interference with possible bloodbath that's going to take place in Central America, El Salvador, the Honduras, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. The far right. Now, the Pope, just before he was shot, had gone to Brazil, and he got very sentimental and gave a ring to the natives and made a plea against poverty and almost sounded like he wanted peace or would be more of an activist towards peace, but that wasn't what he was put there for. He was put there for three reasons, as they explained on 60 Minutes about the Vatican, and one of them is political. And he's there to politicize Eastern Europe for Reinhard Gehlen's Nazi agents. That's why he was put in this position. And if he looked a little too sentimental, he was to take his lesson and shut up. And the shooting did that to him. He came out a full-blooded fascist like he was when he was younger, if there's any doubt in your mind. And now he's going to get after those priests, if he can, who are leaning towards a more moderate way or radical in their feelings towards native populations in these countries. I listed those. That was almost a year ago. Last May, the countries where the bloodbath would take place, and now he's going to call them in and give them their lesson. That's this coming Tuesday. Another article from the Christian Science Monitor, Poland leaves the center stage, focus shifts to El Salvador and problems in Washington. You see, whenever we are caught with certain documents around, such as Iran, we have to back down. The Washington Post has an article, Warsaw charges the CIA manipulated Solidarity, and it lists their activities and money going to Solidarity. Another article in the LA Times, February the 6th, Polish police say explosives and guns are seized. They raided 13,000 criminal hideouts, 4,000 suspects for investigation, 500 special operations against the criminal underworld working in Poland. And they had 12,000 prostitutes, 10,000 drug users, narcotics, poppies grown in Poland, locally grown heroin, and so forth to fund the far right. So the Polish situation, when it gets back down or linked to the CIA, we're forced to push it to the back burner. So now we're moving into El Salvador. As long as we can keep ourselves off guard and shipping arms around, that is what the Pentagon likes to do. I'll take a break for 1 minute and then get back to a matter of Fritz Kramer and Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig and some more on the Air Florida crash.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.